Hello, everyone. Welcome to our April Chatting with Charlie EB-5 Investor Visa Update. My name is Joseph Barnett. I am a partner at WR Immigration. I practice in EB-5. I've been doing this for 12 years. It's an honor to have you all with us today. Our firm has 9 offices throughout the United States. We are consistently ranked as one of the best immigration law firms. In EB-5, we have filed over 4,000 EB-5 petitions on behalf of immigrant investors. We generally do around 10 to 15% of the annual market share. We are very much at the cutting edge in EB-5 and are on various committees to make sure that we understand the recent issues, the gray areas of the law, so that we can advise our clients and have them make informed decisions. Because EB-5, it is a long-term process, it is a lot of money, and it's investors' lives and their children's lives. So we need to make sure that they understand the good news and the bad news. That's our job as attorneys. We have developed in-house our CRM called Rapid, and it won a great award this year as a technology trailblazer. And it is incredible for HR departments, in particular for EB2, EB3, H1B type of work. And we also use it for our EB5 client onboarding, where you are able to securely upload documents. And as we'll be talking about, there are a lot of documents that we will need to demonstrate that the money that is invested in the EB5 enterprise is lawfully obtained and transferred over. And so you can do that with the peace of mind that no one else is going to be looking at it except for your immigration attorney. Of course, this is not legal advice. It's just for informational purposes. I'd be happy to speak with anybody about EB-5. Please feel free to reach out and schedule a consultation with me. So here's our pretty faces. Again, I'm Joey Barnett. I'm a partner. I'm joined by Charlie. Charlie, hi, how are you?
Hi, it's a pleasure to be with everybody today.
Thank you so much for joining and giving us your expertise in regards to the Visa Bulletin and providing projections that'll help everyone better understand what the wait times may be for your EB-5 investment and the ability to get the green card. All right, so here are our topics for today. Who can benefit from EB-5? We're going to be talking about this incredible new opportunity in the new EB-5 law about concurrent adjustment of status processing. We're going to be talking about the relatively recent May 2023 Visa Bulletin, what is happening in other visa categories, and why that is causing many in the United States who are stuck in visa backlogs, either on an H-1B or maybe an F-1 or doing STEM OPT, and why they're looking at EB-5 now when they may not have been before. And that's because with these new lines that were created with the reserved visa set-asides, you can file your EB-5 case and file your adjustment of status at the same time and remain here lawfully. And you can get an EAD within around 4 to 6 months, and you can get your advanced parole and travel internationally around maybe another 4 to 6 months after that. And it is a huge, huge opportunity that people are taking advantage of all of the time. We have signed more EB-5 cases and filed more EB-5 cases in the past couple months than we have for the past few years. Because the new law has been implemented and people are finally understanding this incredible opportunity. I thought I was going to talk a little bit about the EB-5 stakeholder meeting yesterday, but I don't think there's really too much to share. It was pretty disappointing. USCIS, if you're listening to this on YouTube, shame on you for getting rid of two of the three topics that you said you were going to talk about, and just giving scripted answers to questions that I think, to be honest, you guys wrote yourselves. You didn't answer my question or questions that I posted. You just skipped those over. And I know there's other immigration attorneys who feel the same way. So I wish it were better. There still are some gray areas of the law, and we're going to be getting into that a little bit. All right. So who can benefit from EB-5? Really, anybody can benefit from EB-5. There are a lot of folks who can do it. If you're an international student in the United States and you haven't been chosen in the H-1B lottery, this may be a way to stay here. If you're in an H-1B and you're stuck in an EB-2, EB-3 visa backlog, in particular China, India nationals, EB-5 is a great way to remain in the United States. It is possible for funds to be gifted from family members. It is possible to get a loan based on an asset that you already own if you don't want to sell that asset. So there are lots of different ways to finance EB-5. And it's what we're seeing a huge part of. I was just talking last night with somebody who's their daughter, the Chinese national, daughter's at NYU. She has 1 year of OPT. She's going to be working at Deloitte, you know, the big consulting firm, but she is just so concerned about not being chosen for the H-1B, even though she is eligible because it's a lottery. And so she's looking at EB-5 as a plan B. And her mother is going to be loaning her some money to be able to use those funds to invest. And the loan doesn't need to be secured anymore. I guess it never really needed to be, but USCIS's guidance seemed to indicate that it did, until a court of appeals case in the DC circuit said otherwise. And that has opened up more opportunities for people to fund EB-5 investment. It's a really big opportunity. And like I said, we are very, very busy right now with EB-5, and it's a wonderful time to do it. So let's talk about this concurrent adjustment status rule. This pretty much means, so before the new EB-5 law was enacted, an immigrant investor needed to wait for their I-526 to be approved before they were able to move forward and file for the adjustment of status if they're in the United States. The new EB-5 law allows concurrent adjustment of status. So if you're here and you've been lawfully admitted into the United States, you can file your adjustment at the same time that you file your EB-5 case, and you can get your work and travel authorization pretty quickly. Another big benefit is that Congress said that this provision of the INA 245K now applies to EB-5 investors. So even if you have been, let's say, let go by your H-1B employer and you're in that grace period, or maybe you're not in that grace period, the 60 days have passed, well, you're still eligible to apply for adjustment of status if you haven't been working without permission or otherwise violating your non-immigrant status for up to 180 days. So for folks, you know, there are unfortunately a lot of layoffs these days in the tech space, and people are looking at a contingency plan. EB-5 can fill that role. And like I said before, I'm happy to speak with anybody about it. So EB-5, before we get into the visa bulletin, let me just take a step back and kind of discuss what EB-5 is. Let's start with the basics. EB-5 is a job creation program with an immigration benefit. And I say that because if the jobs aren't created, you may not get the full immigration benefit. So the key to success in EB-5, whether you're doing a regional center investment or whether you're doing a standalone direct investment on your own, is job creation. You want to show that jobs are being created for US workers. The minimum investment amount for EB-5 is $800,000. And that's if the project or company that you're investing in and the jobs that are being created are located in a rural area or a high unemployment area or in an infrastructure project. Otherwise, the minimum investment amount is $1,050,000. It is possible to make a installment payment and to file your case and then pay the balance of the minimum investment amount within a certain period of time. That is under the provision that you are actively in the process of investing. And we're seeing that become more and more popular as folks are looking to liquidate assets. If they have investment holdings that they need to liquidate over a period of time for financial or tax purposes, or if they are looking to sell a house or get an like a home equity line of credit, and the paperwork is in the process and they're waiting for the appraisal, but they want to file. So there are lots of different ways that you can fund your EB-5 investment. It can be multiple sources of investment. It can come from within the United States. It can come out of the United States. And you want to work with your immigration attorney to come up with a source of funds strategy so that your case can be approved. The government acts like a forensic accountant. They want to see tax returns. They want to see income statements. They want to see bank statements. You work with your immigration attorney to prepare a legal brief that organizes and explains to the USCIS officer how those funds were earned. And that is a big part of our job as immigration attorneys. And then, of course, it's job creation, right? So you have to invest in a business that's creating jobs. You don't invest in a regional center. You invest through a regional center that sponsors a specific investment opportunity. And there is a business plan that is submitted as part of that regional center's application showing how those jobs are going to be created. You have to demonstrate to the government that the investment project that you have invested in is credible and has already begun creating jobs or will be creating the jobs in the future. And there are ways that you can mitigate that immigration risk by investing in projects where they are either you're repaying short-term bridge financing, which was used already to create the jobs, or maybe construction is already underway and EB-5 is being used to complete the construction. That way you can already get some of the benefit of the job creation for that project. Okay, let me take a breath here. The big benefit of going through a regional center is how you count jobs. If you are doing a direct or a standalone EB-5 case, you have to have W-2 employees on payroll. Whereas if you go through a regional center, you're able to count indirect and induced jobs, which are created through either construction and development expenditures or through operational revenue. And you work with the regional center and the project works with an economist to put together a report showing, hey, based on this amount of money being spent in this geographic area, in this industry category, X number of jobs are being created. And so that's why you need a very credible business plan and you need a reputable economist to prepare an economic report. And that's what we do. That's sort of the basics on EB-5. Now let's get into the fun stuff, the visa bulletin. This here is the final action date, chart A from the May 2023 visa bulletin. And I'm going to start with some basic questions for you, Charlie. You wrote the visa bulletin for decades. My first question to you is, how did the new EB-5 law change how the Department of State drafts a visa bulletin?
When the RIA was passed, the State Department needed to add on the three new categories. Previously, it was only split into two, the C5 and T5, and the I5 and R5 categories were listed separately. Once the RIA was passed last March, and I believe in the May visa bulletin, April or May visa bulletin, they split it out, lumped all of the regional center cases into one.
So the RIA created new lines for EB-5 investors that did not exist before. Is that correct to say?
Correct. What it did with the RIA, it said that of the overall employment fifth preference limit, the rural area got 20% of that overall limit, the high unemployment got 10%, and the infrastructure category got 2%. So it was a tremendous benefit to those that can file in these new categories, because as you can see, they're all listed as current now, meaning numbers are immediately available for any applicant with an approved petition in these categories, whereas the fifth unreserved category, at least for China and India, there is a final action date listed, meaning that only applicants with a date priority date earlier than the listed dates can be processed during the month of May.
And to get to my comment about concurrent adjustment of status of filings and the ability to do that, because all of these set-asides are current and a visa is immediately available, you can file an adjustment of status today and remain in the United States, even if your non-immigrant visa status expires, because you have a pending adjustment, you're here in an authorized period of stay. And that's a huge, huge benefit. Charlie, let me ask you this. Do these visa set-asides, do direct or standalone EB-5 also qualify for these set-aside provisions?
That I will decline to answer because I'm not an attorney. I don't want to give out legal advice.
Okay. Well, the way that I read it is yes. The answer is yes. If you do a rural standalone investment, you still are in this visa category. Same with high unemployment. Infrastructure seems to be limited to regional center investments only.
And based on that, then yes, you know, there is a tremendous benefit to filing in these new categories in this, exactly, that regard.
And so there's been a lot of talk about the May 2023 visa bulletin, in particular for other employment-based categories. And while our focus here is on EB-5, I'm hoping you may just give us a brief overview of what has happened and what you may think will happen in the coming months, in particular for EB-1, 2, and 3, for China and for India.
Right. Real quick, because I've seen in previous chats, a few people have asked, why aren't we discussing the family-based? This is primarily an EB-5 webinar, but I can tell people that I believe the rest of world family sponsored dates will be advancing. They advanced for May. I think the state will continue to advance them potentially through the summer to maximize number of use this year and to prepare for have cases in line next year. With this, in the May bulletin, the China dates are in fairly good shape, with China fifth preference, the unreserved category, advanced significantly. I think that the China unreserved date could, for the month of June or July, could move to November 1st of 2015. I'm still optimistic that it will reach at least January 1st of 2016 by September. And I think that the China employment second and third dates could advance a month or so each for the month of June or July. With regard to India, one important thing for China employment first preference, I believe that in June or July, that February 1st, 2022 date, I believe that it will retrogress and could retrogress to as early as September 1st of 2021. But I do believe the China first will retrogress in the next few months. With the India, as with China, India first preference, I believe it will retrogress again, potentially to September 1st, 2021. The employment second preference for India, I believe it will also retrogress in June or July, possibly as far back as July 1st of 2010. I believe that the India unreserved fifth is also likely to retrogress potentially back to January 1st of 2018. The India fifth preference, the fact that a date was established has already been retrogressed once and is likely to retrogress again. It is somewhat puzzling because the applicants with these dates, the India category was current for an extended period of time, and many applicants should have been able to also be processed last year. One possibility for the need for a date is if the Immigration Service approved large amounts, or if they had large amounts of unprocessed EB-5 petitions and finally got to them, which is very, it is a shame that they didn't process these in a more timely manner when visas were available earlier, and it's now negatively impacting India fifth preference number use.
Well, we definitely are starting to see a pickup in I-526 processing by USCIS. They have gotten into 2019. I received an April 2019 I-526 filing date approval this month, you know, not based on any sort of mandamus or expedite request that shows that that's kind of where they're at in terms of their processing. And we just see based on the numbers and the Telegram data that they're adjudicating more cases now than they were 2 months ago, and significantly more than they were a year ago. So that might be where that extra demand, I guess, is coming from. But to go back to the EB2 and EB3 and how that relates to EB5, why do you think so many folks in the United States who have priority dates of 2000 or EB2, EB3 priority dates of 2014, 15, and 16 are looking at EB5?
For the last three fiscal years, there have been record high employment annual limits. That has allowed, again, record numbers of applicants in the first, second, and third preference category to be processed. For example, in the India second preference category, last year, over 55,000 Indian second preference cases were finalized. Either they were issued a visa overseas or adjusted status in the US. That is a all-time high figure. In starting in fiscal 2024, the employment overall annual limit will be lower, meaning far fewer Indian and Chinese employment second and third preference applicants will be processed, meaning that many of the dates which are in effect now and through the end of the year are likely to still be there, and it's going to take a long time to get back into 2014 or recover to the dates that were in effect at the end of fiscal 2022. So the movement, for long and short of it, India and China movement in the second and third and potentially first preference will not be at the pace it has been in recent years.
And for those who have approved I-140s and are waiting for their priority date to become current, they can't file an adjustment of status. And so doing a set aside EB-5 investment where there is a current priority date right now, or excuse me, there's a visa available for everyone, they are able to file the adjustment today. And with that, sort of get on the track for the green card, you know, get that EAD, and even leave their H-1B employer if that's what they so incline. We have a question here. It's a great question. Says, if it was a rural project prior to the enactment of an RIA and I invested pre-RIA, would I be able to qualify under the new rural set-aside?
I believe that the answer is yes, but I believe that it is possible that the petition may need to be re-adjudicated in that rural set-aside.
So that's what I would be hopeful for as well. Let me say this. There is a lawsuit brought by regional center who did an infrastructure project. The government has fought it. They filed a motion to dismiss, and they have argued that if the new set aside categories are not available for pre-RIA investors, all of those pre-RIA investors go into the unreserved visa category. That does not mean, however, that you could potentially refile a case under a rural, and you know, you may have to invest some more money to meet the new minimum investment amounts, but that may be an option. My answer to this is, unfortunately, no, you're not. Even if the same definition of rural is identical pre-RIA and post-RIA, it is the government's position that you do not qualify for a set-aside. Another question that we have here relates to expedited processing. The first question is how to make sure their projects are eligible for expedited processing. Well, you have to make sure that they have an approval of the project application first. That's the number one thing that you need to see. And it says they're mentioning with an expedited process, Indian applicants will not fall under retrogress. Is that true? That is not necessarily true. It depends on the timing of USCIS processing of your I-526E. If your I-526E is approved before there is a final action date imposed, well, then yeah, you wouldn't be subject to any sort of wait time. But one thing that I continue to say over and over again is that just because it is current at the time of filing does not mean that you will not be subject to a visa backlog in the future, because there is a pipeline of cases pending with USCIS that are not reflected here in the visa bulletin. And the reason why, and Charlie, you can maybe opine a little bit more on this, is that the Department of State doesn't see a demand for these visa numbers at this time because the cases haven't been approved. Charlie, do you want to maybe make a comment on that at all?
Yes, you're absolutely correct. The visa bulletin is an indication of what is, how many numbers are available and what applicants can be processed in the applicable month, not what it will be in the future. So the fact that it is current now, 2 years, 3 years down the road, does not mean it will be current. It is the date, the final action date at the time the case will be finalized is what governs whether it can or cannot be finalized. For example, in this, in the India unreserved with the June 1st of 2018 date, when applicants were filing back then, the category was current. It exactly. is important to remember that it is what it, when it is going to be final action on your case.
So let's talk about the unreserved. I know we have a lot of folks on this call, regional centers or existing investors who are looking at those final action dates and are frustrated at the slow movement forward. I guess my first question to you is, there's the chart A and the final action dates, and then there's the chart B, the dates for filing. How the chart B is sort of a goal or expectation where the Department of State thinks chart A will be in the future?
Correct. When I was there, it may have changed somewhat. We typically, the chart B dates were where we expected the applicable final action date to be anywhere from 8 to 12 months in the future. So that was a good gauge.
And what data does DOS need to push those chart B dates forward?
In collaboration with the Immigration Service, we would look at how many cases were already pending at the National Visa Center with approved petitions in each of the categories. Then we would consult with the Immigration Service to find out how many petitions that, or cases they had on file, at what rate they thought those petitions would be approved and move forward for processing either at the State Department at overseas offices or at USCIS district or service center offices. So we would combine all that information and say, for example, that we knew that we needed to use 10,000 numbers in the next 8 months, we'd look and see, okay, we've only got 6,000 applicants, quote, ready to go at this time. then we would advance the application filing dates to generate demand for another 4,000 applicants so we could fully utilize all 10,000 numbers within the necessary time period.
And so if USCIS processing times are poor, or if consulates are just not issuing visas because of COVID or other in-country conditions, that will cause Chart B to not be pushed forward as far. Is that what you're saying?
It could very well. Or if the Immigration Service, say in the respect to the fifth preference category, if the Immigration Service were to indicate we expect a large amount of applicants to be approved, the petitions in X amount of time, it may be necessary to at some point impose Chart B application filing dates so that too many people do not apply. But again, that is not likely to happen in the foreseeable future because there's no reason for it at this point, since so few petitions have been approved compared to the annual limits.
One question I get asked all of the time, and now I'm asking to you, is how long do you think these set aside categories will remain current?
I think that the set aside categories will definitely remain current through the remainder of the current fiscal year 2023. The simple reason, there's approximately 6,800 numbers available, and there just haven't been enough approved petitions to use those numbers. I also believe that the categories will remain current through at least May of 2024. Again, I think that the reason being, I don't think there'll be enough applicants with approved petitions to be ready for final action and using the visa numbers in relation to the annual limits. And the State Department should only impose a final action date when number use through that point for the current year and anticipated number use based on known demand and expected number use through the remainder of the year will exceed the annual limit. And again, I just don't see that happening before May of next year, possibly later into the summer. Things can, and again, that's based on the best information available at this time. Unfortunately, the Immigration Service is still not publishing a lot of data on, some people are getting it through FOIA requests, which is unfortunate that it needs to be that route to get information that they could choose to publish online.
Well, you heard it here, guys, straight from Charlie's mouth. So I agree. I mean, it makes sense that until we have some USCIS adjudications of these I-526Es in the set-aside categories, there's no reason for demand, and actually or for the Department of State to say that there is demand for these visas. And actually yesterday during the stakeholder call, there was a question about this, and the USCIS employee was sort of, he said, well, you just have to look at the visa bulletin. And like I said previously, the visa bulletin does not tell the whole truth. It does not talk or discuss or reflect the pipeline of cases. But you know, your spot in the line is based on your I-526 priority date, the date that your case is filed. And so what I'm telling folks who are looking at EB-5 is the quicker you file, the less of a wait you're going to have, because the longer you wait, the bigger the possibility that others will file and will get in line in front of you.
Yeah.
Go ahead,
yeah,
Charlie.
It's always important to be at or as close to the front of the line as you possibly can be. And again, the one good thing about the visa bulletin is I always did, and they're continuing with that process. They're trying to put information on visa availability in the coming months in the visa bulletin to give people, quote, a fair warning of things may happen. I don't think that there'll be any notices about the reserved employment categories until probably January or later. But I think that January on, it would be important to watch the visa bulletin to see if they're predicting anything may happen based on number use patterns they're seeing or their consultations with immigration.
Excellent. Now, if you guys have listened to our past EB-5 chattings with Charlie, and I hope you do, they're on YouTube, you'll know that there were over 6,300 unused reserved visas from fiscal year 2022 that, per the terms of the RIA, carry over into fiscal year 2023. And if they're not issued by the end of fiscal year 2023, they are to be made available to the unreserved visa category. And Charlie, I know you've advocated for a reading of the RIA for those visa numbers to be made available in this fiscal year for unreserved. Can you glean anything from this visa bulletin to help us understand if that's how the Department of State is also reading the RIA?
Yes, in my interpretation is those, as soon as the State Department determined that those 2022 carryover numbers were not going to be required for use this year, I believe they should immediately have started providing those numbers to applicants in the unreserved category. I don't believe that is happening because of the large amount of numbers and the fact that the China date has not advanced more rapidly, and that there have been retrogressions of the India unreserved date. Because if they're releasing those unused numbers, carryover numbers, then India would be entitled to a portion of those carryover numbers at the rate of 7%. The other thing is, it's unfortunate. When I would be calculating unreserved or unused numbers, whether it was in the fifth preference category, the employment first, or whatever, wherever, I would try to do so as early as possible in the year in order to start, you know, maximize the amount of time that those numbers could be used. For state to wait, if they wait until September to release these numbers, they're going to be wasted, because there would not be enough time in September to allow the use of those, especially if you have overseas processing constraints, which doesn't allow those numbers. So again, it would have been much better if they had released them early, so that you could kind of ease into the end of the year with minimal numbers remaining that need to be used versus a glut of numbers that need to be used at the end of the year.
And that seems like, based on what happened in fiscal year 2022, a large majority of the EB-5 numbers came at the end of the year, like in August and September of last year.
Right. And that was in part because a huge increase in processing of China cases at Guangzhou.
Right.
You know, that could happen again this year. But again, I think that the Indian unreserved fifth preferences applicants may be disadvantaged if they haven't already started releasing them. Because I think had they started releasing them, I'm not sure why there would have been need for the predicted retrogression of the date a second time.
What are your thoughts about Vietnam unreserved EB-5? We don't see Vietnam in the May 2023 visa bulletin. What are your thoughts on that?
I'm a little confused why, and I think I had predicted earlier that there would be a Vietnam unreserved final action date applied. And the simple reason, the National Visa Center publishes annually a quote waiting list report, the amount of applicants they have on file as of November 1st of each year. The report they published in effective November 1st of 2022, there were only for India, there were 1,362 applicants with approved petitions at the National Visa Center. Vietnam has been, India has been subject to a final action date in the unreserved category. Vietnam had, on that same report, 1,543, approximately 170 more applicants, yet there isn't a date established for Vietnam. So my question would be, if Vietnam had more applicants than India, and India has a date applied, why hasn't one been applied to Vietnam? It's excellent news for the Vietnamese applicants because they're still current. But like I said, it begs the question, why, if they have more applicants on file at NVC and in theory coming through with approved petitions at an equal pace as India, why hasn't a date been imposed like India?
It's logically inconsistent.
Right. And so anyway, it is an interesting thing, but again, without data being published on the amount of cases that they're approving petitions for at the investment program office and all, it makes it hard to speculate.
Thank you. Well, I think that's a very good piece of information, something that we'll be keeping our eye out on in the coming months in the visa bulletin. One question that I see here is, I'm on an H-1B, and if I start the EB-5 process, at what stage will I be moved from H-1B to EB-5? It's a great question. So if you're in the United States and you file your adjustment of status concurrently at the time that you file your I-526, then you are on H-1B with a pending adjustment. They will not adjudicate your adjustment of status application until they approve the underlying basis for it, which is the I-526. So until then, you would remain on your H-1B status, if as long as you maintain that status, until they approve the I-526 and then approve the adjustment of status. At that point, if you have maintained your H-1B status, your status would adjust from H-1B to conditional green card holder. Now, let's say that you left your H-1B employer or you started your own side business and you're no longer maintaining your H-1B status. You're still here lawfully because you have filed an adjustment that remains pending before your H-1B status terminated. And when your adjustment was approved, you would just be a conditional green card holder at that point. Here's a question that's a follow-up. Is this a true statement? USCIS only adjudicates I-526 with filing dates before the current visa bulletin chart B date for filing. These charts are sometimes used interchangeably by USCIS depending on the immigration demand that month. So I think what this statement is referring to is that every month after the Department of State releases the visa bulletin, USCIS will indicate whether someone in the United States is able to file an adjustment of status based on the chart A or the chart B. And that usually comes in either the day of or the day after the visa bulletin is released. Generally, in the earlier parts of a fiscal year, they're more likely to use chart B than they are as you get closer to the end of the fiscal year. And I believe right now for May, they're saying for employment base, you must use chart A. Is that an accurate sentiment, Charlie?
Yeah, it's and I think that typically they do not allow the chart B dates to be used beyond about March. And what they're looking at is they're looking at the annual limit in the employment, and they're looking at the amount of numbers which have already been used and the amount of numbers remaining. if they think that they already have enough demand that is filed to reach the limits, then they'll shut off the chart B and only use the chart A final action dates. If they feel, no, we need to let more people continue to file their petitions, their 485 petitions, et cetera, to reach the annual limit for the current year, then they will continue to allow the chart B to be used. But again, in the early years of their use of the chart B, they would only do it typically for October and November. Then they expanded it to December and January. And again, I think it is typically cut off no later than March now.
Perfect. Thank you. Okay. All right. We spent over 20 minutes on this page. Let's move forward here. We only have 10 minutes left. I really don't want to talk about the EB5 stakeholder meeting. It was really, frustrating and disappointing. It was mostly based on the I-956K registration for direct or third-party promoters or migration agents. They didn't really get into the details about sustainment for post-RIA investors. They didn't really talk too much about regional center operations and how regional centers who are looking to wind down and get out of the EB5 program, but at the same time, remain compliant so that their existing investors can continue to get the immigration benefit, can exist. That's a very big unanswered question. They did seem to indicate that all of the regional centers, whether you have even filed an I-956 or whether it hasn't even been approved, you still need to pay that EB5 integrity fee. I imagine there will be likely litigation on that at some point. They said, no, we're not going to record this. I haven't seen any notes from it, official notes from it. They said they're not going to record it. It was very, very frustrating. I know many immigration attorneys were disappointed in that stakeholder, quote unquote, engagement. We do have some time left. I'm going to answer a few of these questions that we have. Has there been any successful cases with investors applying for the set-aside projects? So what they have indicated in the past is that first, USCIS needs to adjudicate the underlying project-based application that the regional center files before they are able to adjudicate any I-526E filed by an individual investor. And so until there is an I-956F approval, there won't be any I-526E approvals. I am unaware of really any I-956F approvals. There may be one or two that I've heard of, but I haven't seen the actual approval notice yet. So until we get those I-956F approvals, I would not suspect there to be any investor-based approvals yet. Expedited process. Anybody can apply for USCIS to expedite their case. And there is national criteria that you can qualify for in order to get your case expedited. That's for EB5, it's for H-1B, it's for every benefit. As long as there is no premium processing available for that. And in the past, projects have been expedited and investor applications based on that projects have been expedited based on project-related expedited criteria. I haven't seen that happen yet recently for I-956Fs and I-526Es. Hopefully it does, but I have not seen that yet. Here's a follow-up. So let's just say I have my H-1B and I go to EB-5 and then I have issues at the I-829 phase. How can I use my H-1B perm? Okay. Perm and H-1B are two different things. But once you adjust status from H-1B to conditional green card holder, your H-1B status is no longer available. Your approved I-140 does remain valid. And if there is a problem at the I-829 stage, and if there is a visa available based on your priority date for the perm, then it still may be possible to use your perm in the future. It may require you to leave the United States and apply for the new immigrant visa at a consulate abroad, but that is certainly an option. Are clients able to speak with DOS on behalf of their clients in an effective manner when an EB-5 immigrant visa process is stuck due to consular incompetence, including legal overreach of EB-5 analysis? There are limited ways that attorneys are able to speak with DOS. Generally, you can go through their public inquiry system, or potentially if there's been a denial, you can talk to LegalNet, but it is a somewhat of a closed off process. And it is something that we have a lot of problems with, and in particular cases that are just not being scheduled. I mean, we have hundreds of Vietnamese investors who have been documentally qualified for years and are the priority date is current, and they are just not scheduling the visa interview. That has been a huge problem, and we send letters and we don't really get anything but boilerplate responses. Thank you for your patience. COVID, in-country conditions, we are doing our best. Please continue to be patient. It's quite frustrating. There isn't an effective manner to do this. Someone's asking about premium processing. How can that benefit investors? There is no premium processing for EB-5. So that is not, there's no way for that to benefit investors. Let's see what else we have here. In terms of the visa bulletin, how beneficial would it be if the state decides to use, okay, this is a good question for you, Charlie. How beneficial would it be if DOS decides to use the unused reserve visas for this year? And I'm going to assume that you mean towards the unreserved visa category. How would that impact the visa bulletin?
I believe it would provide a tremendous benefit to the Chinese applicants, allowing that date to advance significantly. And I believe it would also benefit the Indian applicants. And I'll give you real quick, because the per country limit as it stands is about 666 for the unreserved categories for any individual country. If they were to apply the carryover numbers, then that limit would approach 1,000. And so there would be, at least 300 extra numbers, which would be available to both to the Indian applicants, allowing that date maybe not to need to retrogress or to advance. So again, it the release of those numbers could be extremely beneficial, because that would mean there is 6,800 or whatever applicants that don't need to be using those numbers next year. Because if they're not processed under the unreserved this year, they're in the line still to be processed next year when there's a lower limit.
I agree with you. And those would go primarily towards Chinese investors in the unreserved category because they have the earliest priority dates.
Correct. If there's otherwise unused numbers under the per country limits, they go strictly in priority date order. And as you said, that would be the Chinese. And that's why I believe the China date could potentially and should advance significantly if they release those numbers.
Excellent. Okay. Well, I want to thank you all for joining today. This will be available on YouTube in just a couple of days if you guys want to come back and listen to it again. You also have our contact information. My email is jbarnett@wolfstorff.com, B-A-R-N-E-T-T at W-O-L-F-S-D-O-R-F.com. I'd be happy to speak with anybody if they have questions about EB-5. Charlie, thank you so much for your time and for your expertise and for giving us all of your insights about where the visa bulletin will be moving for EB-5 and really for all of the employment-based categories. So thank you so very much.
My pleasure.
All right. Well, this has been your April Chatting with Charlie EB-5 Investor Outlook. I hope it helped and it was informative, and we will see you next month. Thank you so much.